Hello and welcome to Towards the Point, an inquisitive light cast on arts and culture for Pompey and beyond. I'm James Sandy, and in this programme, we open our ears and minds to the new album from Beta Band frontman Steve Mason, and we contemplate the protest song After the Ding Dong. We catch up with Ian McNab as he tours his new Eclectic Warrior record, and we delve into French cinema with a look at In the House. Helping me drill another hole in the sturdy ship are resident cultural empaths Dave Allen and Simon Mobbs. Welcome, folks.
Good evening.
Thank you very much.
And we're going to kick off tonight with songs of protest and politics. And Simon, you've thrown an album onto our table, which is the new album from Steve Mason, Monkey Minds in the Devil's Time.
Indeed, yes. The title refers to a religious quote about procrastination and complacency. And before hearing the album, I heard it very much described as a political album about anger and frustration. It's worth mentioning that the Steve Mason is formerly of the Beta Band, which was a very successful experimental outfit from the late 90s, early 2000s. And this has been drilled as the great album that the Beta Band never quite made. I think the thing that's worth mentioning about them, that their work was very irreverent, very exciting, very surreal, very cheeky. I mean, in particular, their first three EPs were very well received from critics, from musicians, from both experimental sides like Radiohead they went on tour with, through to more mainstream acts like Noel Gallagher was a big fan of them. And after these three EPs, there was a definite sense these could be really huge, these guys. But they never quite made that great album. And there's suggestions that maybe the record company rushed them and things didn't quite work out. But if you're interested in the Beta Band, the three EPs is very interesting. Moving through to now, Steve Mason was this many, many years on now. He's had some solo material and he's had different aliases that he's released work through. But this is really, it's been much more somber, particularly his solo work. It's been more singer-songwriter, more like opening his heart out, that kind of thing. Whereas this album, with the political kind of suggestion of it, the more experimental tracks, it's considered to be more like the Beta Band's kind of output, the things that made them so playful, fun and infectious. It's got more of that in there.
And this is his, I think, fourth solo album since the Beta Band kind of fizzled out. And it's a huge album. It's about 20-odd tracks,
like
I think.
Yeah, it's an hour long, yeah.
It's a big listen. And it's kind of, just to give listeners an idea of where it sits, it's kind of, I've heard it described as sort of dub and gospel, but it's got bits of rap and it's got bits of indie music and it's got this ubiquitous term, Americana, thrown in as well. Yeah. So it's an interesting sound. It's a very heavy sound.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think the Beta Band, for example, they mixed folk, blues, and country, but then they also had this electronic and sampling element come, you know, deriving from hip-hop. And that was very sort of popular at the time. If you think of artists like Beck or Corner Shop or even the instrumental work of the Beastie Boys, there was definitely an interest in mixing traditional styles, particularly American traditional styles, with sampling and hip-hop beats and that kind of thing. And there's definitely a sense this comes through 15 years later or so on the Steve Mason album. I'd say on the Steve Mason album, you've got kind of three styles broadly. You've got the confessional singer-songwriter style tracks. You've then got the political tracks, which come about in the last third of the album. And they are more linked to kind of maybe funk like Curtis Mayfield, soul, things like that. There's even a hip-hop track on there as well. And then in between all of these songs, you've got instrumental or kind of collage-y type tracks. Some of them sound like assemblages of news clips. Some of them sound like kind of, like you say, dubby kind of experiments. And it's almost like you get one song, then you get a little interlude, which could be instrumental, could be, you know, experimental. Then you get another song, then an interlude. And it works out like that. So it quite easily, I think there's 11 tracks on the album that are actually songs and about 9 or so that are instrumental.
And there is that real kind of, news clip added in, isn't there, to this? It's something I think that there's an outfit called Public Service Broadcasting do as well. They kind of major on the vocal as the kind of public service announcements. There's a kind of growing trend, I suppose, of this kind of thing. One thing you didn't say about the context, or you touched on it, I think, for Steve Mason, is that he has struggled, I think, in the last few years with sort of debt and depression himself.
Yeah.
And very much sort of fallen out with most of the major labels through various kind of commercial deals and non-commercial things that he wanted to do. And a lot of the things I've read about the album sort of frame it as being about kind of apathy and poverty and rioting, which is quite a heady mix of things to find on an album. It's a really, for me, I sort of came to it quite cold, I suppose, but it's a really intriguing album. And I mentioned just before we started recording that I've listened to it sitting at home and just, you know, with headphones on, and it sounds very different when you're at home stationary to when you're out and about on the bus or walking around. Maybe it's just me, maybe my ears are kind of developing. But it is a strange sound. Dave, what did you make of it?
I've been listening to it in the car, to and from cricket grounds.
Okay.
Which might surprise Steve Mason. Well, I tell you what happens with me, because I don't know, because I'm so old or something, or because I don't any longer inhabit a world where I'm constantly aware of what's new and what's coming out, so you guys will throw something at me and I'll think, oh yeah, I've sort of heard of the Beta Band. So inevitably what happens with me is that as it starts playing the first or second times, I begin to try and think, oh, it reminds me a bit of this, or it reminds me a bit, which is just to sort of anchor my sense of it, really. And so I don't know how much sense it would make to you if I said this, but he sounds to me most of the time through it like a singer-songwriter working with Massive Attack, a kind of gentle Massive Attack.
Mm.
Or the other thing he really reminded me of was Vinnie Riley and Jurati Column.
Mm,
and I just kept getting echoes of that. I would like to say, incidentally, that knowing very little about him and had it not been for you guys, I wouldn't ever have gone to it. I've enjoyed it very much. I think maybe it could have been a little shorter for me. I'm okay with it like that. It's all right, really. There's only one drive I've managed that I got to track 20, you know. So I kept listening to the first 14 tracks, thinking, when am I going to get to the end? And eventually, I did have a drive today that got me through the lot. But
you're praising the traffic.
The only other observation I would make is that apart from, say, the rap track, which I didn't understand, and that's not a critical point, but it just seemed to me to be so different. It was almost like, well, we got these mates who've got a different band and we're going to give them one track on the album kind of thing. Apart from that, I didn't have much sense of it as what you might call a political album. I kept kind of straining to hear the politics. And it sounded to me like a man who was, you know, it starts off, doesn't it, when he talks about how life was when I was 15. And there's another track where he talks about Christmases of long ago. It seemed quite a nostalgic, reflexive thing to me, more than political. But I don't care about that. I enjoyed it for what I got out of it, and I liked it.
I think that's a really interesting observation, because it's described and often sold as a kind of political concept album.
Yeah.
And there is a very broad concept that draws some of it together, but I'm not sure about the kind of, you know, the kind of explicit politics of it. And if I think there's a lot of distraction on the album. Some of the things that Dave mentioned, I can absolutely hear in this record. For me, the sound was very much a kind of mix of the kind of Specials. You know, the Ghost Town track, the Specials.
Oh, right. Okay.
Really, you could hear, particularly in some of the kind of riot dance, should we call it that. There were bits of Primal Scream and bits of Spiritualized, which I know, Simon, you're big fans of those bands. But also, and you're going to maybe laugh at this, but the Muppets, for me, there was a big element of the Muppets to this. You know, there was a good element of kind of theatrical comedy, you know, musical theatrical comedy that kind of, you know, it was kind of poking fun at some of the subject matter. So it was kind of saying, you know, oh yeah, this is a political concept, political protest album, but yeah, there's not such a thing anymore. And I think the wider question is it trying to change the idea of protest through music?
I've got this sense that it was a very personal album, and particularly the beginning of the album is very much about his own personal crises that he's had. It's suggested on previous albums that maybe he's had problems with having agoraphobia and things like that, and he's quite an insular, introspective person. And certainly the first six or so songs fit that. They're about love lost, or about feeling like you're an outsider, not recognising where you fit in society, that kind of thing. And then, like Dave said, about two-thirds of the way through, there's that jolt where you get this MC on the hip-hop style track about the riots that occurred in London. And my understanding is that Steve Mason was living in Hackney at the time, so it's something that would have personally affected him. That suddenly jolts you it suddenly brings it into a wider, you know, set of stories, new stories. And then after that, you get a series of tracks such as Fight Them Back, which are, I feel, definitely very political, but they come as a sort of a couple of them right at the end of the album. And it feels very much like it goes from being about personal crisis to being national crisis. And it's almost like these political events jolt him out of his reverie and he becomes concerned about wider issues. And on the last track, he talks about watching cities rise and things like this, and there's definitely a sense he's looking at a wider picture by the end of the album. And in some ways, it's a journey that takes place on the album.
Well, Fight Them Back is certainly the track, I think, that's been promoted quite heavily, and I suppose that, you know, was sort of the kind of first single. Now, for me, I've got an issue with that, because that's the kind of Muppet track for me. That's the great demonstration of the Muppet sound. But there's also, right at the end of the track, there's a quote from Tony Blair about Libya.
Yeah.
And I think it's a real demonstration of something taken completely out of context, you know?
It's quite a soft track. It's quite melodic and harmonious. It's got song, female soul vocals. It's got sweeping orchestration. It reminds me very much of something like Curtis Mayfield might do.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got Steve Mason's sort of slightly... how can you put it? It's doleful but uplifting croon, I've heard it described, kind of singing over the top. And there's a bit where he says, kind of chorus is, get up and fight them back, a fist and a boot and a baseball bat. That, if you were to hear that on, say, a rap track or, you know, a heavy rock track or something like that, it wouldn't sound out of place. But on this kind of very soft and kind of melodic track, it kind of almost, there's a jarring, isn't there? And I think also it kind of questions, is this a responsible lyric to write? I heard this single before I knew it was by Steve Mason, and I loved it, and I wanted to find out who it was from. And then I found out it was from a guy who did from a beat band. I was like, great, this sounds interesting. But I did kind of have this kind of, should I like this? Is it a responsible thing for somebody to be saying? He clearly seems to be on the side of the youth when it comes to the riots that took place in London. And he was in Hackney at the time, and he doesn't seem to feel that it was a nuisance. He seemed to think that the police had it coming and those kind of things. And that's his view.
It's a strange one. I'm interested on Dave's take on this, because my reading of the Fight Them Back song, which I think, you know, is kind of, you know, an illustration of the album and some of the themes of the album, is actually about non-violent protest. It's actually saying it's futile to riot and smash things up and to, you know, to take this form of action to achieve a cause. And I think partly what he's trying to say...
How do you think that comes through?
Well, I think what he's partly trying to say is, look, there are better ways to make a point. Mm. There are better ways to demonstrate. And, you know, what we need are new forms of protest.
Yeah.
And maybe that's what some of the sort of different styles and different mixing of styles, which to a point I think could have cut across themselves, maybe that's what he's trying to get at. What do you think, Dave?
I did say earlier that it took me a while to get to the last track, so I kept hearing the more melodic things. You know, this is since about last Wednesday, and I've been travelling every day, so I have missed bits that you've talked about, which is interesting. And that baseball track thing, I kept straining to work out whether he was talking about Millwall football fans or some kind of serious political, you know, was he just speaking on behalf of hooligans who were going to have a bit of a rumble? I mean, I'm going to sound like a real old fogey now, but my problem was the problem that my dear old mum had all those years ago, which was that I couldn't actually discern the lyrics clearly enough.
Right.
Whereas if I think about the classic protest songs of the past, you know, I mean, you know, if you think about something like Billie Holiday singing Strange Fruit or Bob Dylan singing Blowing in the Wind, you never strained. Mm. You know, now, in some senses, you could argue that the lyrics are so obvious on those, they're so polemical, there's no room for interpretation or maneuver, but actually you could hear it all. And I think also because I've been lulled into this kind of nostalgic, reflexive human being singing about difficulties in his life and understanding it and so on, I wasn't quite ready to come to terms with somebody who was suddenly and I didn't mind at all being jolted by the rapper, because in a sense that's what a lot of political montage does in all kinds of media. That's a perfectly interesting thing. But, you know, if he was sat here now, I would say to him, actually, Steve, I didn't hear any of that.
Right.
You know, I haven't heard it enough times, and maybe now I could go back and listen to it and make more sense of it. I wonder if you want to be explicitly polemical about politics, whether you actually have to pare down what you're hearing in the background so that the lyrics really stand out.
Mm.
But it may be an old fogey's point of view. It may be a Woody Guthrie type thing, and actually we're not living in the 40s Dust Bowl anymore.
Well, let's move then to the kind of wider question, which is about protest and about political songs. I'm a political scientist, if I can phrase it in that way, and, you know, that means I kind of read The Guardian and drank a lot of coffee at university. I think that's what puts me in that bracket. Now, the New Statesman magazine and the Political Studies Association, I think perhaps 2 years ago, had a stab at coming up with a top 20 protest and political songs. A couple of them, Dave's already mentioned, actually. So you've got things like Billie Holiday's Strange Fruit, which is an amazing song about slavery and about the kind of the fallout of slavery as much as the kind of cruelty of it. Woody Guthrie's on there. I think he's on the top spot. This Land Is Our Land. Bob Dylan, you've all heard of him. He's there. He's The Times They Are Changing is the track that they chose for him.
There's,
there's other things in there, like U2's Sunday Bloody Sunday, God Save the Queen by the Sex Pistols, which is an interesting choice. Gil Scott-Heron's The Revolution Will Not Be Televised, Going On, Marvin Gaye, John Lennon's Imagine, Glad to Be Gay, Tom Robinson.
John Lennon's Imagine.
It's in there.
You've got to be joking.
It's in there at number 18. So it's a strange mix of things.
Well, that's bonkers.
Won't Get Fooled Again by The Who is in there. And it just made me think, actually, about, you know, whether protest songs have to be associated with social movements or social change, or whether, as we've got a very current example, songs can be plucked out of the ether from somewhere in our history and used to protest or to register dissent against particular things or particular people, as we have an example of The Wizard of Oz and elements of that soundtrack being used about a former prime minister. I'm just interested in kind of your take on protest song, whether it...
Well, I'll tell you what, actually, I'm just going to retract my slight outburst about the John Lennon track, because I'd like to make a broader point, really, which, I mean, my own view of Imagine is that it's a hugely sentimental song that's greatly overrated, but that's just a personal opinion, really, of someone who grew up loving the Beatles at one time. But I think there's a key point to all of this. There are many, many songs out there in popular music which are explicitly political in one way or another, and I wouldn't, for example, necessarily select Woody Guthrie's This Land Is Your Land as his best political song, although it would be his best known political song. And I certainly wouldn't pick Times They Are Changing for Bob Dylan. I'd pick Masters of War, which is a far more savage attack on political and commercial interests. But it does strike me that fundamentally, whether a song is political or not is so dependent on context and politics, if you like to play around with a familiar phrase. Politics is in the ear of the listener. So, you know, at the age of about 5, the first feature film I ever saw in the cinema, which I fell in love with completely and with the star completely, was The Wizard of Oz. Now, until 7 days ago, that was a story I could tell. And I don't watch The Wizard of Oz anymore. I've seen it enough times. I know the story and so on and so on. Mm. And that's fine. But it was my first deep love of cinema. And I ended up as a film studies lecturer. And then a week ago, an entirely innocent, playful, messy about tune becomes highly politicised. And it is. Mm-hmm. Now, it isn't political because of anything anybody put into the song. Mm. It's political because of the context and the way certain people are choosing to hear it on both sides of the argument. And I ain't going to get... Personally, I'm not going to express a view about that. I'm not interested in this discussion in doing that. But it is now a political thing. We'll never know how much worse the world was if these things hadn't appeared. If anybody says that popular music is a trivial thing and never has any impact on politics, then this last 7 days has given the lie to that.
Monkey Minds in the Devil's Time is out now on Domino Records, and you can find some of the links to some of the tracks that we've been talking about on our blog, which is towardsthepoint.blogspot.com. We move now to more music in the shape of Ian McNabb, and I was lucky enough to catch up with Ian at his recent performance at the Cellars at Eastney. I'm joined now by the original Mersey Beast, Ian McNabb. Ian, how are you?
I'm very good, and thank you. What a great... The original Mersey Beast?
The original Mersey Beast.
Who was the other Mersey Beast?
Well, I did some bit of research on that. I wasn't clear.
Okay.
So I thought I'd give you that title. Okay. Now, we're hiding out of the back room of the Cellars at Eastney, which is a great venue. A venue you've been to before, or first timer for you?
First time. I can't remember the last time I played in Portsmouth.
Let's start with your latest album, very recent, in fact. I think it came out just the beginning of March, middle of March. Eclectic Warrior.
Yes.
Tell us something about that, because it's a very interesting way in terms of how you've come to put that album together.
Well, it's a play on words. One of my favourite records is Electric Warrior by T-Rex. Mm-hmm. I just thought it was a catchy title, and, you know... It's a play on words.
And you've released this album through Pledge Music. Now, for folks that don't know what that is, can you explain
to them? No, I haven't released it through Pledge Music.
Pledge
is basically this idea, which I think is absolutely brilliant, whereby your supporters, I hasten to call them fans, because I think that sounds like a demeaning title, they pledge money, they pay for you to do the record before you've done it.
So it's quite a modern sort of self-funded model, isn't it? It's a kind of, I suppose, what folks might call the Radiohead model.
So basically your supporters pay for the record, so I don't have to go to a record company, and they pay for it, and what happens is on that site, they get loads of exclusives, you know, like we do video downloads and exclusive tracks. One of the things about it was that it's like, because these people are paying for the record, I really want to make sure they do a really great one. Because imagine if they paid for it and it wasn't very good. I mean, that would be a bad day for everyone, wouldn't it?
Luckily, we don't have to worry about that.
Well, I hope so. So
tell me how that kind of process, or that approach has influenced some of the songs and some of the songwriting. Has it had a great influence, or...?
No.
No.
I write the songs that I want to write about what I want to write about. No, that hasn't had any effect on it at all. The effect it's had is purely that I feel very, very inspired that people have trusted me to make a good record, paid for it without, you know, they paid for me to do a record without even hearing it. So all it does is it makes me feel very confident that they trust me to do something good. So hopefully that's what I've done.
And is it partly a message to the industry as well? Because the industry is a curious beast itself now, isn't it? Is it partly a message to them to say, give artists more space? Or?
Well, do you know what? I'm not bothered about that. I understand what you're saying. It's not a message or anything. What it is it's music. And I don't care about the industry or the message or whatever. All I care about is the music. That is the only thing I care about, and obviously me mum.
Of course.
Yeah, I care about my mum, my family, and my audience. That's all I care about.
I think that's a very powerful triumvirate, if I can use that
triumvirate.
Word.
Triumvirate.
There you go, that's a good word, isn't it? tell me about the band on this album. You've got a band called Cold Shoulder, I think, which is a good name for a band, and they're kind of formed from previous outfits, the Black Velvets and the Aeroplanes, is that right?
Yes.
Bits of both? And...
Yeah, and, very good friends of mine, Chris, who's opening the show for me tonight, and Nick Kilroe, who is currently the drummer in Echo and the Bunnymen, and Andy Lord Ashton, who plays with them, they're the three-piece band. You know, power three-piece. I just thought, such a great band. So I said, how would you feel about me, like, kind of, you know, showing you some songs and we go in the studio? And I play guitar and they're like, yeah, that sounds great. It's the best idea I've had for years. Young guys, great players, a lot of energy.
I think you're at a point in your career where you're very much a kind of solo artist. You've been in bands and big bands as well, and been involved with those kind of things. I don't mean Glenn Miller in terms of big bands, although you might have been, I'm not sure. How do the dynamics change as you sort of go record to record?
The dynamics don't really change that much. It's just all about writing songs and performing them, and sometimes I do it solo acoustic and sometimes I play with a band, and I don't really see that much difference between them. It's all about the songs to me, and the emotion and the passion about that. All I care about is music and writing great songs and great melodies, and, you know, trying to explain to people how I feel, and hopefully they listen to it and go, well, do you know what, I felt like that as well. I don't really see much difference. You know, a lot of the time I'm playing solo acoustic guitar, but when I play with a rock and roll band, it's not really that much different to me, because it's the same thing. The songs are the same.
Mm.
It's all about the songs.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you about a couple of the songs, because there's a couple of songs that are quite personal to me, actually, that through various stages that I love. And one of those is The Icicle Works, When It All Comes Down. That's a really great song, and there's quite a sort of trajectory in that song, and very much a kind of big rock sound, isn't there? Mm-hmm. And kind of, I wonder, across your songbook, how you sort of balance the kind of softer acoustic work with the kind of big rock sound,
well,
particularly in small venues.
Well, When It All Comes Down with a band is a very big, loud rock and roll track, but I play it just on my own, and it's the same. The spirit and the meaning is the same thing. It's like if you're doing a big rock version of it, that's fantastic, and everyone's like going, wow, guitar solo. But I play it just solo acoustic, and it's the same. It's a song.
The other song I was really keen to ask you about is, I think probably one of your most popular songs. I might be wrong here, so you can correct me, but Be Prepared to Dream, which you did with Crazy Horse. Mm-hmm. And there are various things you can read online about how you stole Crazy Horse from Neil Young, but we won't go into that. But
well, I don't mind if you want to go into
that. that's a great anthemic tune.
Thank you.
I have a copy of that locked away somewhere on 12-inch purple vinyl. So there you go, see? I don't know if you've ever seen that. But you've also collaborated with people like Ian Brody and Mike Scott. And I guess as a solo artist, you've got a lot more freedom to kind of...
Do you know what? I don't really collaborate with people. Collaboration means, like, writing songs with, and, you know, it's just like I've just played music with those guys. It's a different thing.
Interloped, maybe. Is that a better word?
Interloped.
we'll try and squeeze that one in there. On your latest album, Eclectic Warrior, there's some really interesting tracks on there. Some really interesting subject matters, I think. There's a couple of songs that stand out for me. I just wanted to sort of ask you a little bit about the sort of meaning and the muse for them, really. One is No Hero to Me. Tell me a little about that.
Well, that's, I've written a couple of songs about American foreign policy. And, I mean, that song is about... I know this is going to get me into trouble. It's a difficult thing to talk about. You know, young men going into battle and losing their lives is a very, very upsetting thing to me.
Is it a protest song, do you think?
No, it's not a protest song. It's like, I understand why those young men do that. Because they've got nothing else to do. You know, these beautiful young guys, you know, very fit and very young, and then they go and fight wars and get killed. And then they call them heroes, and I'm like, look, you're not a hero to do that. You're basically cannon fodder, and it's no disrespect to those young men, but I'm just saying you ain't no hero to me. And hopefully, if I say that loud enough, maybe some young men won't do that. Look, it's no disrespect to them. It's no disrespect. I understand, but they're not heroes. They're just pawns in the game. And, you know, like guys like 21, 22 getting arms and legs blown off. For what? They're not fighting for freedom. They're fighting for bankers. And that's my point. And so no disrespect is meant, but I just thought if I write that song, maybe someone will go. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, very much.
You know,
I think you're very careful with the subject matter of it, which, you know, you very passionately sort of defined what it's about there, which is
well.
Which
I know, I haven't quite finished with that.
Okay, go on.
Because I do respect those guys, but what bothers me is that they think it's dignified to go and do this stuff, and they're not liberating anybody. They're not setting anybody free. What they're doing is they're just clearing a place out because somebody with a load of money wants the oil. I feel slightly uncomfortable about that song. You ain't no hero to me. I'm not disrespecting them. I'm just saying, you're not a hero. Just think about what you're doing, you know. It's a difficult subject.
It certainly has an edge. And I think
a difficult subject.
There's another song that has an edge. And again, I think there are a number of difficult subjects bundled into this, which is Woman Killed by Falling Tree, which you were sound-checking earlier on, which sounded great.
Which I've never played before.
Oh, I've got an exclusive there. That was good. So tell me a bit about that, because that's kind of... it reminded me, actually, whether this is an obscure reference...
I'm loving these questions.
It reminded me a little bit of Leonard Cohen's The Future, which is a song which
What a compliment that is.
It tries to bundle in a whole whirlwind of woes and kind of risk and crisis. Is that where it was going?
Oh, God, I'm so happy.
Oh, good.
By the way, Leonard Cohen is one of my gods.
I'm pleased.
And particularly that track, The Future. Woman Killed by Falling Tree. You're asking me about that tune?
Yeah.
That really nearly didn't make the album.
Oh, okay.
And my producer, Kieran Bell, he went, I said, I've got some songs for the new album. And I played him that one, and I played him a bunch of other stuff. When I got with the band, we rehearsed, and he went, where's that Woman Killed by Falling Tree thing? And I went, oh, no, I'm not going to, I don't want to do it. And he goes, why not? And I went, oh, just because I'm making a rock and roll record, you know. And he went, well, I thought when you played that to me the other night, I just thought that was a really, really great song. So he made me do it. Anyway, okay, long story short, I was laying in bed one morning and the news comes on. It's like BBC News. David Cameron is blah, 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 you know, the world. And woman killed by falling tree. And I went, wow, that's a really good title for a song. So what I did was, the whole thing about that song is, basically it's a guy who's reading the news and there's all this terrible stuff going on. Really bad stuff's going on all the time. And basically all he cares about is his girlfriend has just dumped him. So he's going, baby, make up your mind about you and me, you know. It's like, the world's falling apart. I haven't had any text messages of you. Baby, make up your mind about you and me. I'm really proud of that song.
The other song that caught my ear was the Memory Be Good to Me, Memory Come Back to Me.
Ooh.
Which, is that a reminder to yourself when you're on stage to kind of, which song am I doing now? Or is it about more? Is it more intriguing than that? Is it a personal kind of reminder song or?
Yeah, okay. Once again, another good question. No, it was just a riff. I just wanted to do something that sounded like Down by the River by Neil Young and Crazy or so. I just wanted... but it's got to have a chorus. I went, memory, that'll do.
And how do those riffs come to you? Do they, when you're walking out and about or when you're travelling around, or do you just get it in your head? Or
no, just the easiest thing to play on the guitar.
Just before we wrap up, I just want to ask you about sort of future projects that you might have in mind. You've got things that you're planning to do next, because you're in an exciting period now where you've sort of finished one album and touring it and sort of out there promoting it. But are there other things brewing in your mind?
Oh, God, always. I'm not quite sure what... I've just made 3 albums in 3 years, which, that's pretty cool. Peter Gabriel's made 3 albums in, 30 years. You know. Next thing, I'm not quite sure what, but it'll be something completely different to what I've just done. And I think I might do the Pledge thing again.
Have you got any festival plans? Are you dipping into
festivals? No, I don't like doing festivals. I'm too old.
So you're very much a kind of small gig person, a small venue.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. Ian McNabb, it's been a great pleasure to meet with you and have a chat with you. Best of luck with the tour and the new album.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Thanks very much. Take care.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Yeah.
we move now to cinema and to film. And Simon, in particular, you've been looking at a new film called In the House by François Ozon.
Certainly, In the House is a French film that's currently showing at Chichester New Park Cinema, and it's due to be showing at the Number 6 Cinema in Portsmouth as well. It's directed by Francis Ozon, and it's based on a play, Boy in the Last Row, which is a Spanish play. It's won a lot of awards at film festivals. It's had very favourable reviews. It's one of these French films that's considered to have crossover appeal. It'd be very enjoyable for a lot of English audiences. The storyline is about a jaded middle-aged English teacher at a sixth form school, in a city, possibly Paris, who has his passion reignited for teaching and for his subject by the potential shown in a 16-year-old boy who's somewhat precocious, somewhat unnerving but very talented. He shows a lot of potential in a creative writing task which is labelled What Did I Do Last Week? And whereas most of the students produce, you know, relatively normal stuff, this kid makes his way into the house of one of his classmates who he's intrigued by because he believes they're the perfect family, because they always seem to be happy when they pick up their son from school. So he makes his way into this class, into this family, with the kind of guise that he's going to help with his homework, but instead uses it as an actual kind of impetus for his writing. And the teacher feels a little bit morally dubious about this, but essentially he encourages him because he thinks it's an interesting story and he wants to find out more. So this boy incorporates himself into this normal family's life even more and more, on the guise that he's going to help this boy through his maths coursework. And he becomes more and more kind of interested in the father and the mother as he gets to know them. And it's got a lot of themes about there, about voyeurism and also about storytelling. You know, what is fiction, what is reality? These things are often blurred. There's often scenes which are highly exaggerated, and then you'll get the realistic version of the scene as well. And about halfway, two-thirds of the way through the film, you're not sure if you're reading this boy's fantasy or you're watching something which is actually real.
Is it a comedy or is it a dark, erotic thriller? That seems to balance on that, doesn't it? And I know that comedy is based in tragedy. I remember reading that somewhere at some point. It's probably Dave told me. Probably those blackbirds in his garden again probably told us that. But where does it sit? Is it comedic or is it?
I think in tone or genre there's about three things going on. It's like a black comedy, and it's very much like a Woody Allen film, I would say. There's a lot of middle class educated people talking quite often quite wittily. An element of suspense thriller in this, because he is breaking his way into his family, and you do wonder if it's all going to go a bit wrong, and there's a suggestion that maybe it could go a bit wrong. And it's also kind of a dissection of storytelling, you know, the actual process of storytelling itself.
So there's also something in what you've described, and certainly what I've read about the film. I haven't had a chance to see the film, which kind of disadvantages me slightly, I think, but there's something in this whole plotline, and certainly in the screenplay, which is about a kind of loss of creativity, but also at the same time there's a kind of, you know, there's this kind of fear of creation. You know, the teacher at the centre of this is thinking, I'm washed up, I've had it, you know, I've had my opportunities, and now I've got an opportunity to create something and perhaps live a part of my life that I was never able to. Is that in the mix?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's worth mentioning that his wife is quite a significant character in it, and she's played by Kristin Scott Thomas, who's an English actress but has appeared in many, many French films. And in contrast to him, who works in education as an English teacher, maybe still holds on to his ideals that he had about reform in his youth, she is a jaded art gallery owner, this would-be kind of avant-garde art gallery that's failing to make money. And she's very much like, well, you know, if it sells, I'm going to book it kind of thing. And they actually have a conversation at one point where she asks him, why are you helping this boy so much? And he says he wants to teach him about literature and thus teach him more about life. And she makes the argument that, well, does literature actually teach us anything about life? And he says, well, you know, she makes the point, for example, that John Lennon's Kinner had a Catcher in the Rye copy. He says, well, maybe more than it does about your art exhibitions and your work that you show. And she says, my artworks are the same. Art in general teaches us nothing. And he very much argues, well, it awakens our sense to beauty, but she's, no, it teaches us nothing. And it does kind of raise these questions. Can we gain anything from literature or from art? Can it actually help us? Or is it just merely a kind of superficial kind of pleasant experience that we go through?
Now, usually when we bring films to the table here, they're in English, which helps me because I more or less speak that. Now, Dave, French cinema, just for the uninitiated, would... for me, I'm talking about, that's the uninitiated, are we talking about films from France, or are we talking about a genre, a style of film?
Well, I think there are certain tendencies within French cinema. I think the first thing to say about French cinema is that 95%, maybe even more, cinema began in France, and with two key innovators, really, at the end of the 19th century. Two brothers called the Lumiere brothers, who made documentary films about ordinary everyday life. Now, when I say documentary films, I'm talking about things that lasted 2 minutes. You know, a couple with their baby, a train arriving at a station, the workers in their factory leaving the factory, and all on fixed camera. So, but just, you know, literally slices of real life, you know. So they set that whole pattern of the relationship between cinema and realism. And then on the other hand, at almost exactly the same time, there's this magician called Georges Méliès who discovers by chance what you can do by editing. And he does it by mistake, where he switches off and leaves a camera on at certain points. When he plays this film back, he realises that the person he was filming has suddenly vanished. And it was just an accident about when he turned the camera on and didn't. And you may be familiar with the stories of Méliès, because that's the story in that recent film by Steven Spielberg about the French station, the title of which has completely escaped my memory. But whatever it is, about the little boy, and he discovers that the grumpy shop owner on the station is in fact Méliès. And it's Spielberg's homage to Méliès. And Méliès makes the first fantasy films, the first sci-fi films. He makes films, you know, 20-minute film called Trip to the Moon, which is phenomenal in terms of its staging. So what you've got with French cinema is its roots are the roots of cinema. You know, very definitely before Hollywood. The reason that America takes over is that in the period from 1914 to 18, when American cinema is growing, the French are engaged in warfare with the English and the Germans and so on and so on, and so the Americans, you know, get a head start. But there are other key moments, particularly post-war, where French cinema was the most innovative of all, and the whole new wave that comes in the late 50s and early 60s, Godard, Truffaut, Chabrol and so on and so on, and was rooted around the fact that these guys were both critics and filmmakers, and they had a magazine called Cahiers du Cinéma.
Which is French is beautiful.
Which is French for Cahiers du Cinéma. a hugely influential thing. And one of the things that they did was to move away from this reverence for art cinema into a reverence for genre. And they loved some of the great American directors who they would talk of as auteurs. And I mean, Hitchcock is one of them, and I understand that this film in the house has certain Hitchcockian elements, you see. So the other thing I would say about French cinema, which you can see also in French Impressionism and so on, is their willingness to engage particularly with middle-class city life. Mm. You know, the paintings of Renoir, the paintings of Degas and Manet and so on, often just about, you know, Night at the Opera or eating out or the cafe in Paris or so on. And this is clearly another, you know, another addition to all of that. It's not a genre in itself, but they do like reflecting and philosophising about contemporary or recent middle class, particularly French life.
That's definitely a theme that comes across in this film, because the 16-year-old boy who's got this talent for writing, he, it's suggested, is from a working class background, and he is very much learning about middle-aged people and the ways of the middle class through this experience, either it's through getting to know his teacher better or through infiltrating him into this middle-class family. And he questions it. He questions, these people are meant to be people I look up to in society, but are they actually morally wise? Are they actually happy? What's going on here? And he questions it with a kind of steely kind of intelligence, which is interesting.
So you mentioned that this is potentially a crossover film. That's the that's the phrase that you used. Now, to me, what I understand by that is it popular intelligent film? Is that what we're trying to get to? Is it, you know, is it something that's kind of more perhaps thought-provoking, more perhaps a deeper film than, you know, your usual kind of...
I would liken it to Woody Allen film.
Yeah, you mentioned Woody Allen.
In that it deals with some kind of more kind of complex themes, and certainly all the characters are morally dubious. There's not one fully pleasant, agreeable character in it. They've all got some kind of thing that you question in them. And but it's quite witty in parts, and it's got quite a lot of punchy dialogue, and it's quite funny at times. I mean, there's a bit in it, for example, which is quoted a lot in the trailer as well, where he is walking through this boy's house and he says, "An odour caught my attention, the singular scent of a middle-class woman." And there's bits in it like that which raise a wry smile. It's definitely very funny.
Is it? I'm sorry, I was only going to let the listeners know that I've worked out the name of that film I was rabbiting on about.
Go on, what was
Hugo.
Hugo.
You know that film? No. Beautiful. Spielberg film about the little boy who meets up with Méliès.
I was going to ask, is this writing about writing? Is this, you know, it's an ultimate indulgence, isn't it, for screenplay writers to write about the process of writing and screenplay?
Yes, yeah, definitely. I mean, as I say, it's originally based on a play, but it's very much about, you know, why do writers write? What do they get from it? What do you say to a young budding writer? I think it questions as well, you know, if you're going to get your inspiration from real life, at what point are you just kind of observing and at what point do you become a voyeur? It's interesting.
I wonder if it really is the ultimate indulgence, or whether actually it's to pick up Christine Scott Thomas's comment, whether, and actually to take us back to the question whether you can really write political songs.
Yeah. Mm.
Is it actually fundamentally, in the final analysis, the only thing you can do?
Yeah.
It's modernism, isn't it? Yeah. The only thing painters can do is make paintings. They make paintings about paintings. The only thing musicians can do is make music about music.
Mm.
But when that particularly becomes problematic and takes us off somewhere else is when there's words.
Mm.
So it's instrumental music. It can be music about music. As soon as there's words, there's some kind of content, you know, and I don't know, really. I would have thought that the answer to Christian Scott Thomas' character is to say, yeah, there are things you can learn from literature. You can learn about literature.
Mm.
You may not be able to learn anything about life. Mm. I'm not sure about that.
Yeah.
But you can certainly learn about literature.
Yeah. I think it's what's really nice in the film is that the main character, the teacher, who is played by a French actor called Fabrice Luchini, what's very nice is he starts off as very jaded and quite slumped, and you see his passion reignited as he basically starts personally tutoring this boy, and he really knows his stuff about literature, and he really talks about it with great gusto, and that's a nice touch to the film, the way that he gets so involved with it, and it becomes apparent that he could have possibly been a considerable writer in his youth and so on. Yeah, there's some interesting elements. What I would say, if you're going to ask for my opinion of it, I think there's a couple of elements. There's a black comedy element, which works very well. It's a funny film, but the suspense thriller element doesn't work.
Mm.
And as Dave said, it does make references to Hitchcock films such as Rear Window in the cinematography, but it doesn't have any of that suspense. And I found myself drifting off a little bit in the last half. I was still laughing at some of the gags, but I needed a little bit more intrigue to keep me going to the end of it.
There's some really, from what I've read about the film, there's some really interesting kind of counterpoints throughout it. So you've got the kind of pupil-teacher relationship. And I, from what I can gather, there's a lot sort of questioning who is the teacher, who is the pupil.
I mean, I think that's another issue there, in that he's a bit bumbling. He's a little bit non-assertive. This is the teacher, I mean. He's very soft. He wears soft-looking clothes. His whole atmosphere is very soft. And then you've got this very sharp 16-year-old who's got this intense kind of quietly confident kind of nature. And pretty soon I thought, this teacher's no match. This boy's going to win. And I felt for me there needed to be more more of a battle there. There needed to be more vulnerability on the 16-year-old boy's side, because pretty soon it was like, this kid's just going to have him and eat him for dinner.
Well, I've been a teacher all my life, of course, you know. All my adult life, at least. And, there's a danger in these kind of glib phrases, but there was a phrase that I learned many, many, many years ago from Buddhism, which was the idea that any teacher who's not learning from the pupil ain't a teacher.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was always one of the kind of strongest things in my life, really. That I don't mean every minute of every class with 30 people in it, but if you went away at the end of a day and you thought, I've not learnt anything from any of these people today, then you hadn't had a very good day, and they hadn't probably either.
I don't think this film sheds a very good light on teachers. You know, I don't think it's necessarily realistic. I don't know any teachers that would do what this fictional character does in this film. He doesn't really put up much of a fight. He easily breaks morals that he shouldn't break. And you don't feel any sympathy for him as a result of it. You know, he crosses boundaries that he shouldn't, and then therefore the audience loses the respect for him.
It's one for the summer holiday rather than the Easter break, I would suggest, from what you've just said there. Just remind folks where they can go and see the film locally.
Okay, so it's currently on at Chichester from Friday the 26th of April through to Thursday the 2nd of May. And it's also going to be showing at the number 6 cinema in Portsmouth on Saturday the 25th of May.
just before we go, we've just got time to tell you about a few events and activities you can indulge yourself in locally. On Tuesday the 30th of April, you can catch Paddy Ashdown as he gives the Cockleshell Heroes lecture at the Royal Marines Museum here in Portsmouth, based on his latest book, A Brilliant Little Operation. If you fancy going along to that, you can call 023 9281 9385.
I want to mention the work of a painter, an artist, Paul Nash, at the Palant Gallery in Chichester, which I hope we might do a review of in a month or two's time. There's a collection by a woman called Claire Nielsen, and it includes illustrated books, wood engraving, photos, letters and so on. I have a particular fondness for Paul Nash, so I'd recommend that, and that started now. And then on Wednesday the 24th, there's county cricket at the Aegeus Bowl, and I can't resist giving it.
He had to get it in there.
Hampshire, Worcestershire, 4 days.
There's a new exhibition due to be starting at the Aspects Gallery at the end of the month, from the 27th of April through to the 7th of July. I Am Algorithm, video works of an experimental nature, also incorporating sound, which ask the question, where does progress end?
I must just say thanks to our friends at the Cellars at Eastney for their help with the Ian McNabb interview. Thanks to Dave Allen and to Simon Mobbs. We'll be back at the end of May for a special programme focusing on sea shanties. You can find out more about that on our blog, towardsthepoint.blogspot.com. That's it for now. We'll join you again next time. Towards the Point is a King of the Buttons production for 93.7 Express FM.